Welcome to this week's Current Federal Tax Developments, brought to you by Kaplan Professional Education and your State Society of CPAs. I'm CPA Ed Zollers from Phoenix, Arizona, bringing you the updates for things that happened in the current week in taxes. This week, we're going to look at a few things. We're going to start out with kind of a news break item that came from a speech yesterday from the acting IRS commissioner that gives us some information on when we can expect some guidance for the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act issues. We'll look at a court case where a father's testimony was believed by the court to determine where his son lived during the year. But another father who ended up with a problem with his son because he attempted to help his son deal with the fact that his son didn't have a general contractor's license while dad did, and that ended up costing dad money. The IRS issued some new relief for 965 transition tax issues, and we'll look at an IRS memo that talks about some confusion that arose due to special meanings that words have in taxes, and kind of reminds us of having to be careful about sometimes using what might be common words when they have a very specific technical meaning in the tax arena. Interesting thing happened on Friday of this week. We got an article that's going to be posted Monday. It's in Monday's edition of Tax Notes Today, and tax analysts post that on the Saturday weekend, so we know what's coming on Monday's edition when I'm recording this on Saturday. It's an article posted basically by Nathan Richman. It is pass-through deduction regs expected within weeks. It's in the Monday, June 11th edition of Tax Notes Today, and the electronic citation is 2018 TNT 112-2. This particular article that will appear on Monday in Tax Notes Today describes a speech given by IRS Acting Commissioner David Cotner. Cotter, I should say, not Cotner. I always want to put an N in there. But he gave a speech on Friday in Virginia where he outlined some dates for when we expect guidance to come down about certain items under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. One key issue, because he had previously indicated that it might take longer to get this, is he said that we expect the sum of the 199 Cap A proposed regulations should be out within, quote, a couple of weeks. Now, again, that's kind of a vague statement. We don't know how many is a couple, but if you assume a couple is two or three, then it would seem likely that we expect to see this coming out before the end of June. Last month, he had said we wouldn't see it. Actually, just a couple of weeks before, he had indicated that this guidance would be coming out in mid-July or late July. So some are reading this as meaning that maybe things are going a little bit better at the IRS for when this stuff will come out. Now, he also indicated that they hope to take this stuff final by the end of the year on the pass-through deduction. They understand the importance of the pass-through deduction and the importance of getting some guidance out so people can begin doing things related to this tax benefit. He also brought up discussion of the state and local tax workaround regulations. He noted, which I thought was somewhat interesting, that the IRS hadn't planned to have to issue regs in this area, which is, you know, kind of, wait, like within days of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act being passed, we had states coming up with these particular workaround programs. So I'm not sure why he didn't think they were going to need guidance. But apparently the IRS initially had thought they didn't need guidance in this area. There would be no need for regs. Now they suddenly decide they need regs. It may very well just be a change in the IRS position that they have decided that the existing law was not going to be good enough for them to work around the state and local tax workarounds that have come out of the various states. Not sure what changed, but apparently they finally decided regs would come out. But the big takeaway is he told us that these regs will be out in weeks, not months. Now, that probably implies, since he didn't use that term, couple of weeks, that these may take a little longer than the 199 Cap A regulations, or at least the initial part of those. But presumably, by sometime in summer, we should know what the IRS position is going to be on the various state and local tax workarounds, at least the charitable contribution-based ones, since those were the ones the IRS primarily referred to in their notice that they gave to us earlier about these regs coming down. That will be helpful because, again, as a lot of commentators have noted, the IRS is looking to thread the needle and most likely wants to come up with a method that will disallow the most recent ones that were enacted with an eye toward working around the rules on that were passed in TCJA for deduction of state and local taxes, but not necessarily deal a fatal blow, or at least not to or to keep problems down as little as they can about a blow to other state credits that exist that also give a credit for taxes paid. And I think, unfortunately, in some ways, because remember, the IRS is trying to thread this needle, we've seen a lot of places where various charities have been marketing now those credits as a way around the state and local tax deductions. So even if they weren't enacted meant to do that, now they're saying, they do it. That is probably complicating the IRS's ability to write regs to be as laser focused as I think the agency may want the regs to be, just concentrate on what they may consider to be bad faith legislation that was enacted. In any event, keep your eyes on those regulations, even if you're not one of the three states. 30 states have at least some form of 100% or close to 100% credit for contributions to various charitable or state-run organizations. You need to be careful to see how the IRS decides to try to thread this needle and whether they have any, other casualties that come up out of this for existing programs that now can't meet whatever the new reg definition will be. So keep your eye on that one. I think that one may be more interesting than you might think. You might think it's just going to be limited to the states that have passed these rules, which would be New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, kind of Oregon. Oregon's a little different. And we may have another kind of out of California coming. That one hasn't passed, but it's still in process. So we'll have to see how those things go. Let's go to the first case we actually have a write-up on this week. If you get our materials from the website or you go to the website, this is the case of Ingesser versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2018-29. This decision was issued on June the 4th. This is a case of a taxpayer, and it's one of those things you run into, quite often. We have a taxpayer. He and the woman he had been living with, have a child. They have a falling out. She moves out of the apartment. And the catch is, though, she doesn't move very far away. The case doesn't really say they're in the same apartment building, but it certainly sounds like they are. They're like down the hall. So she's out of the apartment, but obviously they're very close to each other. And now the question becomes, Mr. Gessener attempts to claim a deduction, claims basically the exemption and the tax credit and earned income credit based on, and being, to be honest, head of household, based on having this child who he maintained a household for over half the year. Well, the mother also claimed the same status. Now, the mother's case is not before the court. What's before the court is his case. The father testified in court that the child lived with him. But there were a few things that they had. The catch is, aside from the testimony, we had a few facts that we could have in evidence. There's a very limited amount of documentary evidence, but there was some. In 2014, they had a letter dated, they said for 2014, they had a letter dated October 14th of 2015 from a pediatrics doctor that stated that the child was seen in the office on November 10th of 2014 and December of 2014 and March in 15. And according to the records of that office, that child resided with, the taxpayer. And a U.S. Postal Service, change of address form dated December 4th of 2014 changes the address from one apartment to the other. So we have another, a form there. We also had then in after 2015, we had a letter from the Old Bridge Townscript Public Schools dated August 26th of 2015, said that the child was residing with the dad, presumably in August of 2015. And the taxpayer initiated a custody proceeding in 2015 to gain full custody over the child. There were various things happened. Eventually, the custody was awarded evenly. And then finally, the mother got, in essence, his custody was eventually reduced in time. Now, the IRS said, based on all that, he hadn't shown that he had maintained the household for over half the year. But the tax court said, we're not so sure we agree with you, IRS. They said, none of the evidence really said it's very sketchy, but none of it actually goes against the taxpayer. They said the change of address form was interesting, but they said, but IRS presented no evidence about who actually put that change of address form in. for the child. You know, did the mother put it in to attempt to, you know, indicate a change at that point in time? So the kid had been with her and he put it in. Nobody knew who put the change of address form in. At least nobody testified that they had done it. They also said, you know, the evidence they did have, you know, the medical evidence said it was he was with the father. That was where the doctor believed the child was, which would probably suggest the father had brought the child in. And they said it's all consistent. The fact he filed for custody in 2015, they said he plausibly testified that was to clarify the custody arrangement, you know, at that point in time. So the court said all of this is just as, you know, in line with him having the child for over half the year as with the mother having it. And to be totally honest, what really probably carried it here was the court believed him. He was a believable witness. And a big issue there almost always comes down to, did he get caught in a lie? Did he get caught? Could the IRS point to a point in time where this taxpayer had misled or lied to the IRS, stated something that now could be proven not true? And the catch in this case was they didn't have any such situation where they caught him stretching the truth or hoping he'd get away without them knowing something. And that, by the way, is huge because in this case, it all depended on the court deciding that, oh yeah, we believe the father. Now, for a father who doesn't have such a nice result, this is Gaunt versus Commissioner. I guess the idea here is don't let your kid grow up. This is Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2018-78, June 6, 2018. Dad was in the contracting business. He was a contractor. He builds pools. Okay. His son had a plumbing business. And his son did various plumbing related to pools. He worked with his dad on certain pool jobs. But he also did certain other jobs. Now, apparently these other jobs could only really be done by a licensed general contractor. And son was not a licensed general contractor. So son was doing these jobs, but he couldn't do them. And I suspect most likely under state law couldn't do them. So what they did to get around that problem was they had the father's business. The father claimed he just basically worked as a front. He would go ahead and be the quote contractor, but he had no contract with his son. His son actually performed all the services. And then after the money came to dad, dad would then send the money on to the son. You know, the idea being he'd do that. And on his income tax return, he actually claimed a deduction for the amounts that he had paid to his son, stating that, hey, you know, I owed him for that because he actually did all the work. And we were just using my name because my son wasn't a licensed contractor. So he has these deductions. The IRS challenges those deductions on the return. They said, wait, those are not ordinary and necessary business expenses. Because your son was not working as a contractor for you. You had no business relationship with him. Your business has no right to claim that deduction. And because of that, we're disallowing it. Now, remember, the income's already in there. So now dad's going to have to pay tax on the amount of money received on those jobs that the son did. The tax court agreed with the IRS and denied the deduction. Now, if you look at that, that's kind of a harsh result, but I suspect we can explain it, and maybe not so much in tax law. Here's the problem. Courts don't generally like when people come in and are admitting that they have essentially flouted a law, that in essence, it was illegal to do what I did. So we did it this way to get around the law and evade the law. Dad also had a bunch of other deductions on the return that were eventually disallowed for non-support, et cetera. Dad apparently just probably, unlike the taxpayer in the case we just discussed, this taxpayer, I suspect, did not make a good impression on the court. So the court effectively decided, well, what you're telling me is if I'm going to give you this deduction, I have to accept your testimony that you entered into an illegal transaction and lied to the state by claiming that you were the contractor on this job when in fact, you know, your son was doing the work as a non-licensed contractor. And because of that, and because you weren't involved in this, you know what? You were cheating and we're just not going to give you a deduction for the payment to your son to implement the cheating. We're going to go ahead and pick up the income because these people wrote the checks to you. but we're not going to give you a deduction for the work done by your son. So I say, if it had not been an quote, you know, what was kind of, let's say, trying to evade a rule type of situation, I suspect we might have had a different result, been a little more sympathetic. But it's difficult in court to go in and say, yeah, we're just kind of ignoring the law because we don't like it. That doesn't fly well. Next up, the IRS has now announced more Section 965 transition tax relief, I should say. We'll see that in IRS news release 2018-131. This came out on June the 4th of 2018, and they again modified their wonderful set of frequently asked questions on their website, questions and answers about reporting related to Section 965 on 2017 tax returns. Again, on our website, the article we have about this development, and as well in the PDF file that we have that we use for this, and that you can download as part of this week's video. If you go there on the website and watch the video, you'll actually see the link. You watch the video or stream the audio. There's a link to the PDF. We point you to that particular set of frequently asked questions, which if you are paying 965 transition tax, your client has paid it, that's the place you got to go right now. That's where all the guidance is sitting. The first thing they did was they have added three different questions and answers to the frequently asked questions beginning at question 15. Now, the first thing they did was they dealt with something the AICPA had pointed out. If you remember, just a few days before the filing deadline, the payment deadline for the first installment under the transition tax, for those of you who don't recall, 965 transition tax is a tax on certain earnings and profits held in foreign corporations by certain U.S. shareholders, right? You know, there are tests for each, there are levels for each thing, and has not previously been subject to tax in the U.S. And that tax is going to be paid as if those funds had been repatriated under the old rules. But you had a right to pay the tax over 8 years. It was based on a reduced amount of it subject to tax. You know, it's a nice complex thing. On the frequently asked questions, you've got all the details about computing the tax, how you do it, all that fun stuff. So you can go there for that. But what happened was you were able to get your payments over in 8 installments. The IRS had told us that we had to pay that installment separately. We knew that early. But then the bombshell came just a few days before the filing deadline. They said if you were overpaid on either your 2017 tax or you overpaid that first installment payment and you have 965 transition tax and you have not fully paid the amount of the tax, which of course, if you're doing the installment method, you're not going to, any excess payment on either your 2017 regular tax or the 2017 installment payment has to be applied against the unpaid 965 transition tax. That is, there will be no refunds as long as you have outstanding 965 transition tax. So effectively until we get to year 8 and we finally pay it off, if you're overpaid, any overpayment's going to go to reduce the outstanding balance on the transition tax. Well, the AICPA said, wait, taxpayers may have overpaid their taxes, figuring that was going to cover the first estimate. That's something people do all the time. They know they're going to be on extension. They just decide I'm going to way overpay my taxes because I know I'm going to owe a first estimate and we're not going to be able to know what it should be at, you know, that's solid. And this gives me some safety valve too in case I had not totally paid my 17 tax properly. Well, the AICPA said these people are relying on that. They're going to have no first quarter estimate. And you gave them only a couple of days, they probably didn't know about this problem. So the IRS is now saying, okay, we're not going to penalize you if you weren't able to apply an overpayment. And if you do get a notice, send in the reference to this and we'll take care of that. So you won't get a first estimate. But what's interesting about that notice, though, is it tells us one other thing. The AICPA had asked the IRS to reverse course on this and allow you to designate, you know, if you had paid in enough to cover your first installment and you'd paid in enough to cover 2017 taxes and you had the ability to defer the payments on the others for that whole 8-year period, you should still be able to get a refund. This notice still takes that same position. You know, the fact they've given relief on the overpayment you know, the underpayment of estimated tax payments for 19, or for 18, I should say, that implies that they're still planning on keeping the money. So that may be good news or bad. That may be bad news, shall we say, in the guise of good news. There's also another thing that would have been nice to know come around the due date this year on April 17th. If your total 965 transition tax liability is less than $1 million, the IRS provides that they will not charge you a late payment penalty if it turns out you underpaid the first estimate, which apparently would also count if you just didn't pay it at all, as long as you get the proper amount paid in by April 15th of 2019, the due date for the 18 return. Now, what that means is, why that's important is because under 965, if you've made the installment election and you ever get assessed with a underpayment, with the underpayment penalty, right, failure to pay penalty, that accelerates the entire remaining balance of that installment payment. So what the IRS is saying is, if you did underpay at April 17th of 2018, we're not going to use that to force an acceleration of the entire rest of the tax due. That was something many of us were concerned with, and that was what was causing a problem back there in April. You know, we figured it was 95% sure the IRS was going to waive a penalty because of how late guidance came out, but they never said they would. And it became, well, I can't guarantee they'll do it. So it means that probably if we're not sure of your 965 transition tax, and for many taxpayers, we were not sure at that time, and we're still not sure, we're still working on it. What we need to do is make sure that we pay more than we expect would be due. And that's what sets up the problem with the refund. If you were overpaying by what you think was a significant amount, you may have just made the IRS a gift many years earlier than you had to. So in any event, you'll see how that goes. Finally, it adds a provision that says if a taxpayer had already filed their 2017 return and didn't know they should have made the election to pay in installments, they do provide a method there for making the election on an amended return through October 15th. You only get it through the due date. You know, it's going, so they're going to treat it as one of those, you know, under this, basically the automatic 6-month election rule, even though it's a statutory, even though this election, you know, this date was in the law, you had to make payments by that date. They're going to say, you can still use what's effectively that rule that says, as long as you make your election by October 15th, 6 months after the original due date of your election, that's going to be considered a timely filed election. So that's also good. Again, if you have any clients who have this 965 transition tax issue, you want to make darn sure that you keep checking the IRS's webpage that explains us the frequently asked questions, because that's where all the guidance is sitting. Finally, let's go on. And, you know, words have unique meaning in tax. And in Chief Counsel email 2018-22028 that was issued on June the 1st, we have an issue here about the use of words. And this particular email addresses confusion that was found in IRS training documents. Now, the training documents talk about, you know, making changes to payroll tax returns. And what it tells them, it says this, the training materials say an employer cannot, all caps, claim an adjustment for income tax withholding additional Medicare taxes after the close of the calendar year for the employee. Now, the problem is that, as it turns out, they are using two terms, claim and adjustment. And there are two different issues in play. There's the concept of a claim, which has a definite meaning under the code, but that was not the meaning they were using here. They were using claim as a stand-in for file. And then there's an adjustment, which has another meaning for payroll taxes that's different than a claim. And the other catch is adjustments. You know, we'll talk about adjustments here in a second and what they are and how the issue works. But it's also not true that you cannot file your adjustment after the close of calendar year for the employee There's a little quirk there. Yeah, that's also a real problem we have writing training materials. And I say this as somebody writes them and writes articles. And this is a problem we have with articles. It's a problem we have with training materials. You know, everybody that writes about tax has this problem. Whenever you are trying to take technical material that may be voluminous, and you're trying to put that into, let's say, a continuing education manual, you're trying to write up a section for something like the federal tax coordinator, you're trying to do something for tax news, like we do on currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, you have to essentially try to, you know, boil it down. First thing is, we're not just going to post the raw data. You know, you're not just going to post, if there's 60 pages of regulations, you know, we're not just going to do a data dump of the 60 pages, because then you just go read the 60 pages. Your theory is, you know, you want these people to kind of boil it down. But the problem with boiling it down is, and you want them to translate it, right? You know, let's say to use terms that are more understandable rather than use a whole bunch of technical jargon that you're not going to understand. So with that in play, when you're writing training materials, unfortunately, you can run into the very issue that the author of these materials ran into. You end up creating problems. Okay. Now, let's start with the ideas. What is a claim? A claim. We file claims for refund. Okay. Okay. That normally when you're filing an amended return and you want a check, you're asking the IRS to process a refund. It's a claim for refund. Claims can be filed generally on most taxes, you know, until the statute for claims expires. However, in payroll taxes, because here's the catch, I'm withholding taxes on Joe. I'm putting that on Joe's W-2. Joe's using that W-2 to file his 1040. If I go back in 2 years and say, aha, I withheld too much income tax from Joe, I misread the tables. So I want a refund of the excess income taxes I withheld from Joe. The problem with that is that the IRS has already sent that refund, you know, those that excess funds, either to Joe or applied it against Joe's taxes. So realistically, that money's already gone somewhere else. So generally, in this case, you know, a claim cannot deal with anything except what's an administrative error. What being an administrative error? Let's say Joe is my only employee. I have federal withholding taxes on Joe's W-2, which is what I really took from his wages, of $2,000. But when I was filling in my 941s, I accidentally made that total withholding for the year $3,000. Well, that's $1,000 that was never actually taken from Joe's check, never actually, you know, was shown on Joe's W-2. That's a claim. I can still file a claim so long as the standard 3-year statute is open. I can get my money back, right? Because in that case, that money didn't go anywhere else, right? Now, the same basic rules apply to excess, you know, the extra FICA tax, the extra, I should say, Medicare tax under the rules that came in with the net investment income tax. Remember, we have the additional Medicare tax. That's also one that goes into it, treated as a withholding effectively for Joe. So that's subject to very similar rules. So claims can be, but so a claim, if I miscalculated, but I didn't really take the money from the paycheck, I can file my claim. However, let's say I miscalculated, but I did take the money from Joe's paycheck. That's what's called an adjustment. An adjustment is something where, okay, I should have taken $1,200 from Joe's check for FICA and Medicare, but instead I took $1,500. That's an adjustment. Now, if I notice the error before the end of the year in which it occurred, then I can file an adjustment. An adjustment is where I go back, and I've got to do a couple things. First, I actually give Joe the money and get a certification from Joe. I gave him the money. Right, certify that I gave Joe the $300. But if I give Joe the $300, which I do owe to him because I shouldn't have been taking that out of his check, then I'm able to, you know, or let's say for federal withholding, let's say federal withholding, not Medicare. Let's make it federal withholding. I took $300 extra. Yeah, because Medicare is a little different. Or I should say Medicare, other than the additional Medicare tax, a little different. So I took $300 more from him in withholding than I should have. I give Joe back that $300 and I file the claim. If I file the claim, everything's fine. You know, I file an adjustment. See, I'm even confusing the terms. So I file the adjustment. I can adjust on a 941X. I can actually get the money back, but it has to be discovered in the year. Now, what was wrong with her statement as well was I can still file the adjustment outside of the year it occurs. So I could, I've got to discover the adjustment by December 31st. So I discover the adjustment. I discover the problem on December 31st and I get the money back to Joe. If I do that, and what effectively is really going to matter here is the W-2 shows the right number, then I can still file the adjustment in the later year. I can actually file for the money from the adjustment in the later year, but it has to be discovered in the same calendar year in which it occurs. I've got to show discovery. As I say, this is interesting because especially when you're reading third-party sources, and that includes the stuff I write on currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. It includes the things that are in the manuals that we use when we give the courses here at Kaplan Professional Education. And it means, you know, the stuff you read from CCH, RIA, you know, the tax book, whatever, wherever you're getting your information. If it's not the exact IRS source, not the exact source from this court, from the government agency, you've got to be very, very careful in understanding, you know, are they by simplifying, potentially confusing the matter? That's what's happened here. The chief counsel obviously now is suggesting that these training materials should be revised, to essentially avoid using the word claim as a synonym for file, but rather, you know, split the two up very carefully. Interesting case, interesting issue, and something that I think all of us need to be aware of whenever we're reading a third-party editorial source that's trying to explain the tax law to you. Be aware that, you know, it's very easy for them, any author, myself included, to fall into this trap. As we always like to remind you, this wouldn't exist if it wasn't for those courses that we're doing with the state societies of CPAs. So you want to go ahead and make sure you take a look at those courses and sign up for them. You know, I've already done a pair of courses on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. I'm coming up on a set of courses this week. I'll be doing a multi-state taxation course in Arizona on Monday in Phoenix, which is actually going to be broadcast as well. The bad news is, of course, we timed this just wrong to miss the Wayfair decision. So we expect, you know, unless they drop it on us Monday morning, which is highly unlikely, we're going to discuss how Wayfair will impact. I'm going to talk to you about that. Also going to talk a bit about market-based sourcing, which is also a key multi-state taxation development we're seeing. We're seeing states move more to this concept of market-based sourcing. We'll tell you what that is. We'll also be dealing with Arizona ethics and then a 4-hour Arizona income tax case in Phoenix on Tuesday. I'll go to Tucson on Wednesday, talk about real estate partnerships. The following week, I'm off to the East Coast. I'll be in New York City, Manhattan specifically, at the New York Society of CPAs offices, talking about partnership taxation advanced issues. As I recall, that course will also be broadcast from the New York State Society. Then I will go on nearby over to Roseland, New Jersey for the New Jersey State Society of CPAs. And there we'll talk about income taxation of trusts and estates and do financial estate and tax planning for those over 55. We've got those courses. There are a bunch of other courses you can find at your state societies. And it's not like there's not a whole lot to get up to date on this year. As I say, almost every topic, we're going to talk about something that was changed or is impacted by the changes of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, or we're talking about state tax issues. We're going to try to deal with whatever Wayfair tells us. So there's lots of stuff you need to get up to speed on. This is not a year to be studying from CPE materials that are self-study that haven't been updated in 2 years because you're probably missing something. So really nice year to go get your live courses at your state society. Again, this has been the Current Federal Tax Developments here for this week. Remember, we post updates during the week on our website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you have any questions or comments, you can email me at zollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I tend to post on Twitter. You want to follow me there at Ed Zollers. And I also follow discussions on the subreddit of Tax Pros subreddit at www.reddit.com/r/taxpros. You can follow along there. I also post, if you're a member of the California Society of CPAs Tax Talk group, which is open to any CPA around the country. It's a Yahoo group, Tax Talks group you're looking for. Ask for permission to join. If you're a CPA or attorney in any state, you should be allowed in. Or the Arizona Society of CPAs, there you need to be an Arizona Society of CPA member, their listserv. I monitor there as well. So if you want to take a look, we have lots of interesting discussion in all those locations that deal with developments in tax. Otherwise, as I said, I've got courses to do this week. We'll go out, do my courses, and I'll be back hopefully next week recording yet again as we talk to you about developments here in the area of federal taxes that are going to impact us as we go forward, trying to figure out how the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act are going to work for us and our clients in the coming year.